This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the holidays coming, there may be some cheap wine and hopefully fine wine in your future. Jay McInerney has written about both, from the Matus that seemed so sophisticated when he was in college to the rare wines he collects today. Yes, it's the same Jay McInerney who writes fiction and who first became known in the 80s for chronicling the New York City club scene in his novel Bright Lights, Big City. His six novels include Brightness Falls and The Last of the Savages. For the past 5 years, he's written a wine column for House and Garden magazine. Those columns are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me, Adventures in the Wine Cellar. McInerney wanted to find a new vocabulary to talk about wine and avoid the clichés like comparing wines to flowers and herbs.
It just seemed to me that someone with a new set of analogies and similes and metaphors might have a legitimate place in this genre. I tend to compare wines more often to poems, composers, pop songs, fashion models, actors and cars than I do to things that grow in the garden.
If, for example, you describe white Burgundies as very Catherine Deneuve, more Jules and Jim than Die Hard.
Well, this would be a particular white Burgundy because, of course, other white Burgundies would be more Kate Moss, for instance, Chablis.
Right.
I admire people who have, there are wine critics who have these incredible olfactory instruments, you know, who can detect aromas of honeysuckle and cocoa and... almost any of us can get this sort of cigar smoke stuff, but I don't feel that, I don't feel that's my strength. And I also feel that there is something very subjective about the appreciation of wine, and the role of a wine enthusiast, which I take myself to be, is to just get people interested in trusting their own subjective impressions.
Well, wine writing and wine collecting is often seen as kind of snobbish, something only for people who have lots of money and lots of time on their hands.
Yeah, it is. And that's something certainly that I've tried to address and dispel a little bit in my column. I mean, I think that, humor is the best weapon against this particular aspect of the wine world. As far as snobbery and expense go, I think actually we're at an interesting time in the history of wine in which it's quite possible to drink very well on a very modest budget. Technological advances have made good table wine a lot better than it was 20 years ago, and there's an awful lot of stuff you can get out there for $7, $8, $10, for instance.
What are the technological advances, and how have they changed the taste of accessible wines?
Well, until fairly recently, until the advent of stainless steel tanks and refrigeration technology, before this was widespread throughout Europe, white wines tended to be very frequently spoiled. And very frequently short-lived, even if they weren't spoiled. Cheap white wine was a very dangerous and ugly proposition until very recently, something that was likely to be acidic and nasty, as likely to be acidic and nasty as to be fresh and fruity and all the things that we want in a white wine. Technology isn't always a bad thing, although... For a long time in California, they carried technology, I think, too far. They, naturally, being Americans, we tend to believe in technology. And in the early days of California winemaking, chemicals and refrigeration and filtration were relied upon to the point that they often stripped the character out of what really is a sort of a living organic substance. I think now... There's a nice balance in our understanding of what technology can and can't do. The best stuff takes place in the vineyard. The French believe that the wine is made in the vineyard. The Californians, until recently at least, tended to believe it was made in the cellar.
You write that when you started out writing about wine, you were pretty uninformed and uninterested in California wines, but you've since changed your mind about that. What got you to change your mind?
Well, about the same time that I started writing, I think there were a lot of California winemakers who were turning to a more natural approach, who were starting to make sort of interesting, quirky, artisanal wines, you know, wines that didn't taste like they had come out of a laboratory. That was also partly a question of education, visiting California and tasting some of these wines. I grew up on the East Coast and spent most of my life in the East Coast or in Europe. And for a long time, it seemed that the value from France and Italy was a little better. The French had a string of great vintages in the 80s, and I found myself too busy collecting and drinking these to really discover California until recently.
When your editor told you that your first column should be about Chardonnay, you say you wanted to murder the editor. Why?
Well, at the time, I just felt that California Chardonnay was a bore. You know, essentially the Pamela Anderson of the wine world, you know. I mean, I have nothing against, you know, artificial blondes with, you know, with large synthetic breasts, but, you know, I you know, it's not really my type. And that was pretty much the way I felt about California wines. I felt that they were unsubtle, that they were overblown, that they tended to derive a lot of their flavors from the oak barrels that that they were aged in, and I think that I was right to some extent. However, I was sent on assignment to California, and I discovered that there are exceptions, increasingly so, and that there were some great winemakers who were challenging that kind of monolithic palate. But, you know, the average California Chardonnay was I thought, a terrible beast. And so this was my feeling as I ventured forth in my first column.
But at the same time, you write that Chardonnay, in almost any price range, is the most idiot-proof wine in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Not necessarily subtle, but you say, like Harrison Ford, it gets the job done.
Yeah, yeah. It's the Harrison Ford, the action hero of the white wine world. I think there are more... I think that there are certainly more subtle wines. There's subtle grapes than Chardonnay. On the other hand, Chardonnay is very versatile. It can be grown in a wide variety of climates, and it tends to sort of transmit messages from the soil, the winemaker. There's a huge spectrum of flavors associated with Chardonnay. But in general, I think partly just because we're all used to it, it's a safe bet at a dinner party. You know, you're taking a chance when you serve Riesling or Viognier to a new group.
Let's go to the other extreme for a moment. What's one of the most kind of rare and special wines that you've had that was a real memorable experience for you?
Well, my favorite white wine, I wouldn't drink it every day because it is a little exotic, is called Condrieu. It's made from the Viognier grape. They do grow it in California, but I wouldn't really recommend the Californian product yet. They're still trying to figure out what to do with it. It's a very temperamental grape, but it's a beautiful, beautiful white wine when it's vinified correctly. The best example comes from this region called Condria on the Rhone Valley. Whenever I have served it or ordered at a restaurant, people have inevitably called me at some point to say, "What was that wine that you ordered?" And they're thinking about a date or something like that. It has a very haunting fragrance, which is very floral. A friend of mine who's far richer and better traveled than I am, told me that it smells like the garden in the Hotel du Cap on the French Riviera, and I'm willing to take his word for it. It's actually become a bit of a cult wine in recent years.
But you yourself would be more likely to compare a wine to a movie or a poem or a song. So
yeah, to me,
rather than
to
a
me,
garden, is anything to me, come to mind? Yeah.
Well, to me, what Condria reminds me of is his Coleridge's poem, Xanadu, or to Coleridge's poem, Kubla Khan. and the Kublai Khan's Pleasure Dome, the great unfinished poem that he wrote supposedly when he was whacked out of his mind on opium. It also reminds me a little bit, I'd say, if Chondria were a painting, it would probably be something by Fragonard, or possibly by Gauguin in his Tahitian period, if that helps you at all.
What kind of response do you get to these analogies in your columns?
They're meant to be suggestive and not definitive, but...
He said this was like Gauguin, and it isn't. I tasted that wine. It's not like Kublai Khan.
It's definitely, definitely Van Gogh. I think they're helpful, but as I say, as I said earlier, the responses that good wine evokes are subjective, and they're often ephemeral. A great bottle of wine can taste different on different occasions, depending on the context, depending on one's mood, depending on one's palate, depending on the temperature. I think, you know, even the great Robert Parker, who tends to rate wines on the good old numerical scale, on the 100-point scale, would agree that wine is not a fixed, objective, fully quantifiable substance. So these are starting points, I think, for the appreciation of wines. But when we meet a great wine, when we taste a great wine, we want to say something more than it's good. And this is the quest, really, of the wine critic, to say something that seems to give resonance to the experience.
My guest is novelist Jay McInerney. His wine columns are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Jay McInerney. He writes a wine column for House and Garden magazine. Those columns are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me. I guess a lot of people want guidelines on how to look for wine or what to do, what not to do. And you've done your job in presenting 10 rules. let's just talk about a couple of them. Avoid artichokes. What's wrong with artichokes and wine?
Artichokes just pretty much kill any appreciation of any ability to appreciate fine wine. They asparagus is also pretty tough. It's just chemical elements in these foods that tend to turn almost any wine bitter on the palate.
So you should drink beer instead if you're having artichokes? Or Coke?
You should probably just sip your water and wait for have a piece of bread after you finish your artichoke. I've heard of sommeliers who actually take on the challenge of trying to match a white wine with an artichoke, but I've never found a successful combination. I ran into some guy in France last year who won the World Sommelier competition, who claimed that he found some Swiss white wine that went really well with artichokes, but I don't believe it.
You say there's no such thing as a bad champagne.
Well, that's hyperbole, perhaps, but it's true that there are very few bad champagnes imported to the United States. Generally speaking, the quality level in champagne is as high as anywhere in the world. All of the major champagne houses make a great product, whether it's Moët or Veuve Clicquot. Mumm's has gotten much better in recent years. I love French champagne, and it is pretty hard to get a bad one unless it's badly stored. You want to buy your champagne someplace that has a high turnover, because it will get a little funky if it's kept in a warm place for too long.
You say beware of famous European vintages in their youth.
Their youth. Yeah. One of the things that allegedly makes a great vintage is the ability to age. A lot of these wines are very tough to drink when they're young. Oh, just to take a recent example, the 1995 Bordeaux is by most measures a great vintage. However, it's very, very tough on the palate right now. It's very high in tannin, which is a preservative agent. It tastes like you'll know the taste of tannin if you think of a tea bag that sat in your tea for too long. That is what makes wine long-lived, but it also makes for a nasty experience early on. And the 1997 Bordeaux vintage, for instance, which is not judged to be very good because it won't be long-lived, is a much more pleasant beverage right now. The problem, of course, is that a lot of these wines will be consumed by people who have looked at vintage charts and heard that 1995 is better than 1997. So sometimes the off-vintage can be a better bet on your restaurant wine list.
How has writing about wine affected what you eat and what else you drink? And your whole approach to eating.
It has made me more food conscious and more more interested in food, because to me the two experiences are inextricable. You know, in France and in Italy, they tend to think of wine as food. I remember I was over for a tour promoting my latest novel a couple of years ago in Italy, and I was always being urged to have a glass of wine with lunch, and I said, I don't drink at lunch. And they looked at me and they said, it's not drinking, it's wine. Wine, looked at in one way, wine is food. And I think that the appreciation of wine is greatly enhanced by the right kinds of food. It's one of the adventures of wine appreciation is matching wines with food.
So, like, say you're having a fine wine. I mean, I suppose you're not going to have pizza with it or a hamburger. You should be having something that's as subtle as the wine itself.
You can. Actually, a hamburger would be fine, but I would say lay off the ketchup.
Uh-huh.
You know, you could have a hamburger with a great California Cabernet. And if you are going to have wine with pizza, it should be Barbera, which is an Italian wine, which has very high acidity, which cuts through that acidity of the tomato sauce. There's a lot of simple wines that go very well with simple foods.
Name some more good simple wines.
Well, let's see. Again, another tomato sauce friendly Italian wine would be Dolcetto. You know, Beaujolais is a real all-purpose kind of a wine. We're now in the Beaujolais Nouveau season. I personally don't like the Beaujolais Nouveau. I find it too fruity and flamboyant, but to go with it, much of anything. But Beaujolais is sort of a year after vintage, you know, after they've actually had a chance to settle down and age a little bit, can go with almost anything. Côte de Rhône is another great simple wine. We've just had an incredible year, the 1998 vintage in the Southern Rhone Valley was spectacular, and almost anything you buy that says Côte de Rhône 1998 is going to be terrific, and it will probably cost $8-$10.
Now, in the wine column, do you ever feel like you're running out of words because you're describing something similar? You're always writing about wine. Now, granted, there are subtle differences, but it's still wine.
So far, I don't feel I've hit that point. I am concerned that it will come any moment, though, and I think that's when I resign from the wine column. It's still fun. It's still fresh for me. I feel like I'm still finding ways to express my appreciation for wine. I'm still finding new similes for some particular wine experience, and as long as I feel that way, I'll probably keep doing this.
Now, another thing, you're writing about wine all the time. You could be writing, say, about books. If you were writing about new books, you'd be writing often about people who you knew or who you might know or who might be reviewing your books at some point. Is it less complicated to write about wine in that respect?
Yeah, it's much less complicated. It's nice to have another world, I guess.
Uh-huh.
It's also less fierce than the literary world. I was terribly concerned about being an interloper, about how the insiders would feel about my arrival in their world. And in fact, I found the world of wine and food professionals to be extremely welcoming and congenial, something I don't think anyone would say for the for the American literary scene.
So with the holiday season being upon us, what do you plan on drinking for, say, Christmas and New Year's. Do you have that planned?
I'm trying to decide about Christmas dinner. It will either be Burgundy or Pinot Noir. I haven't decided which, but
and why?
As I get older, my taste shifts a little more toward Pinot Noir, which is the grape of Burgundy. It's more food friendly than Cabernet Sauvignon. Cabernet Sauvignon is a little bit more of a club than Pinot, than Burgundy. It's more subtle. It's more aromatic. It's really a food wine, and I'm at the moment divided between an Oregon Pinot Noir and a Gevrey Chambertin. We'll see, and champagne will also be part of the meal. We'll start with a good champagne like Krug or Veuve Clicquot, La Grande Dame, or even the old reliable Dom Perignon, which, despite its fame and availability, is actually a truly great champagne.
Well, Jay McInerney, happy eating, drinking, and writing. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Novelist Jay McInerney, his wine columns from House and Garden are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.